Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, we're watching a very different approach to the most recent outbreak in Ebola in Africa, which is impacting a remote region of the Democratic Republic of Congo. Dozens have been sickened by the deadly disease, but this time around, global health officials have quickly mobilized.
Well, Doctors Without Borders has deployed medical teams to the region, and the newly created Ebola vaccine is being sent to the region as well. And this is a vaccine that was created in the wake of the Ebola epidemic just a couple of years ago, which sickened 30,000 people, killed around 11,000 people, and global health officials learned so much from that epidemic when so many things just seemed to go wrong.
But it did provide one important opportunity, Margaret, an accelerated push to create a workable Ebola vaccine. The World Health Organization and other global health entities worked together to develop the vaccine, knowing it was essential to continuing any future Ebola outbreaks. Recent trials, though, have confirmed the vaccine was highly effective in humans. So that's good news for health workers on the ground and highlights the absolute importance of following the protocol of good science when putting new tools into the marketplace.
It does indeed, Mark, and I have to say I don't think there's been enough of a worldwide shout-out to the scientists who created that vaccine, so let's give them a shout-out today. Just an incredible contribution to the world. And all of this brings us to our guest today, John Carreyrou, who is an award-winning investigative journalist for The Wall Street Journal, who uncovered a significant fraud in recent history, a multi-billion-dollar Silicon Valley startup called Theranos, which created quite a sensation for promoting a technique that would, as they said, revolutionize diagnostic testing. Their founder claimed that it could test a tiny drop of blood for up to 800 conditions, and a lot of investors came into that circle.
Even while investors were pumping billions into the company, there was skepticism about the claims. Mr. Carreyrou pursued the story and uncovered a high level of fraud that not only duped investors, but put hundreds of thousands of patients at risk. He's written a book about his investigative work called Bad Blood. Really looking forward to hearing his story.
And Laurie Robertson will stop by, the managing editor of FactCheck.org. She looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain. But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com or go to iTunes.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you.
We'll get to our interview with John Carreyrou in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. World Health Assembly has recently convened to tackle some weighty issues impacting global health. Representatives from member countries of the World Health Organization addressed a wide range of topics, including global preparedness for the next pandemic, which experts say is only a matter of time. Since the WHO took heat for not responding nearly quickly enough to the Ebola epidemic of 2014 and 15, they created a Global Preparedness Monitoring Board to ensure their readiness to respond to outbreaks of any kind, anywhere. The response to the most recent and much more contained outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo has been swift by comparison, with rapid deployment of both Doctors Without Borders teams and a newly created Ebola vaccine. The Assembly also welcomed the incoming Director General of the World Health Organization, Dr. Tedros Ghebreyesus, who is facing a mounting number of challenges, including increased incidence of new and recurring virus outbreaks such as Ebola and Zika and bird flu, but also growing global antibiotic resistance. Meeting all of these global health challenges requires money, and budget shortfalls are a constant strain at the organization, which is funded in large part by more than 100 member nations, and one of the largest, the U.S., has said it's scaling back financial investments in global health initiatives. One of the WHO's significant campaigns seems to be close to achieving its 30-year goal, with only 5 cases of polio reported worldwide in the past year. The 30-year polio eradication campaign appearing near completion. That campaign underlies the uptick in global childhood immunizations as one way to advance population health. Meanwhile, malaria kills some 450,000 people per year worldwide, most of them children, and affects millions. The Gates Foundation is lending some significant support to an effort. Bill Gates announcing he's backing gene editing experiments using CRISPR technology that can alter mosquito DNA to render them infertile or to program mosquitoes to become incapable of carrying or transmitting malaria. While he admits the technology unleashes a host of unknown risks, he says it could prove a viable weapon in the quest to eradicate this deadly global illness. Does vaping or using e-cigarettes help a hardened smoker quit? Well, a recent study suggests that may not be the case. A study published in the New England Journal of Medicine looked at 6,000 smokers offered cessation programs, and there were some interesting findings. Participants who were given financial incentives or rewards had a much more significant cessation rate than those participants who were given e-cigarettes, along with free cessation aids. At the end of the six-month period, the financial rewards group showed the only significant achievement in remaining smoke-free. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with John Carreyrou, two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist at the Wall Street Journal and author of Bad Blood, Secrets and Lies in a Silicon Valley Startup. It's a detailed account of the dramatic rise and fall of Theranos, a multi-billion dollar biotech startup that had promised to revolutionize diagnostic testing. Mr. Carreyrou joined the Wall Street Journal in 1999, where he covered business and international terrorism. He was named bureau chief for Southern Europe and later became the health and science bureau chief at the Wall Street Journal. Mr. Carreyrou has earned numerous other awards, including the George Polk Award for Financial Reporting and the George Loeb Award for Distinguished Business and Financial Journalism. He earned his BA in Political Science and Government at Duke University. John, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you for having me.
As I was reading your book, and it is a page-turner, you know, I started to think about the American financial schemes, sort of Ponzi schemes, and I started to think about Enron and Bernie Madoff and AIG and Lehman Brothers. And, you know, I was thinking we hated all those people. But, you know, we loved Elizabeth Holmes and the sort of prospect of Theranos and what it offered the opportunity for. And I wonder if you could just give our readers sort of the thumbnail sketch, if that's possible, of what happened here.
Right. So Elizabeth Holmes is a young woman who dropped out of Stanford in 2003. She was 19 years old, and she dropped out because she had a vision, which was to basically pioneer a blood diagnostics product. And at the time, she had this vision for an armband that would have these little microneedles that would draw blood from your wrist and diagnose you with whatever ailed you, and then, you know, simultaneously cure you by injecting the appropriate drug. Turned out that that was pretty much science fiction. So she then pivoted to a device that she wanted it to be a more sophisticated and complete version of the blood glucose monitors that diabetes patients use to monitor their blood sugar. She wanted it to be a machine that could do every lab test known to man, and she wanted to do it off just a drop of blood pricked from the finger. And by 2013, 2014, went live with the technology in Walgreens stores. She had a partnership with Walgreens, and the company sold shares in a fundraising round in early 2014 that valued the company at more than $9 billion. And Elizabeth Holmes became Silicon Valley's youngest female self-made tech billionaire. And it sort of fulfilled this desire that people had in Silicon Valley and in American society at large to see a woman break through among all these tech visionaries and billionaires, you know, the likes of Mark Zuckerberg and the Google founders. And so she was that first female tech billionaire for a little while. And then I came along and the Wall Street Journal came along, and we revealed that things weren't quite as they seemed.
Well, John, it's interesting looking back. I don't remember being so excited about her becoming the first female billionaire in Silicon Valley as a founder. But I do remember being pretty excited about the potential for that blood test. But I think what is most surprising to me about the story now is the number of very sophisticated, high-level investors and industry leaders who were so quick to jump on board based on little more than claims from Elizabeth Holmes as the company founder. You know, we've read about the carefully orchestrated media events to promote the Edison Mini Lab, the machine that could allegedly conduct hundreds of diagnostic tests on just this tiny drop of blood. But yet, as we understand it from your work, scientists on the inside were actually pretty well aware that the technology just wasn't there, didn't work. What made it possible for so many investors to be duped?
Right. Well, she rolled out the blood test in Walgreens stores and then used that really as validation, sort of confirmation that the technology existed and worked because she had gone commercial with it. And so a lot of the investors who came and put hundreds of millions of dollars into the company in 2014, 2015, did it largely on the strength of the fact that Theranos services were available to the public. You know, how that came to be is one of the most incomprehensible parts of the story when you think that Walgreens, the retail partner, got duped and didn't do really any due diligence. Mm-hmm. There's a chapter in my book that explains that Walgreens actually hired a lab consultant to vet the Theranos technology and then didn't really listen to him. He traveled to Palo Alto and met with Holmes and her boyfriend, Sonny Balwani, a couple times, and he started smelling a rat and tried to alert Walgreens executives, and they basically ignored him. And Sonny and Elizabeth asked Walgreens to exclude him from meetings and from these weekly video conference calls, and Walgreens ended up marginalizing its own consultants. And as a result, Theranos was able to roll out in Walgreens stores, and then the investors saw that and thought, well, this has got to be the real thing, right? Because mm-hmm. it's commercial. Mm-hmm.
You know, John, I'm wondering if you could walk through how you found your entry point into unraveling the story. I understand with the tip from a reader in the backdrop, there were threats of lawsuits, rumors, intimidation within the company. Numerous claims made by Ms. Holmes simply didn't add up. But tell us about that journey that you followed, your sort of investigative instincts and how that unfolded.
Sure. So she had risen to fame pretty much in June of 2014, and the thing that really made her break out was this cover story in Fortune magazine. But she didn't come onto my own radar until about 6 months later when I read a profile of her in the New Yorker magazine. That story left me with a strange feeling. There were some aspects of it that were off to me. The notion that a 19-year-old college dropout who had just two semesters of chemical engineering courses under her belt had dropped out and pioneered groundbreaking new science, I didn't quite buy, or at least I was skeptical of. It's possible for that to happen in computers and software. You know, you can pretty much teach yourself how to code at 10 years old on your father's computer the way Mark Zuckerberg did. But in medicine, you really do need real training and put in years of research to really add value. That being said, I probably wouldn't have done anything with it if I hadn't gotten a tip about a month later. And the tip came via a practicing pathologist in Columbia, Missouri, who moonlighted at the time as the writer of this obscure blog called Pathology Blog. And he had read the New Yorker story too, and knowing a thing or two about blood testing, was immediately skeptical about the claim that you could do so many tests off just a tiny capillary mm-hmm. blood sample. And he wrote a skeptical item on his blog and was immediately contacted by this little group of Theranos skeptics, one of whom had been embroiled in patent litigation with Elizabeth Holmes. Uh-huh. And that person's name was Richard Fuse. And it so happened that Richard Fuse had just made contact with the laboratory director of Theranos, who had just left the company and mm-hmm. was alleging all manner of wrongdoing. So when I heard this, my ears pricked up. Mm-hmm. But I felt that if I could get to a primary source, then, you know, this might be the beginning of a story. And sure enough, over the ensuing weeks, I did make contact with him. And he was petrified because lawyers for Theranos were hounding him and threatening him. And so I agreed to grant him confidentiality. And then he started opening up to me.
Well, John, what's really remarkable to me is how far they were willing to go to carry on the fraud in the face of so much damning evidence about the failure of Edison to perform on any reliable level. And I think what seems like where that cliff would be is at the point that real-life patients and medical decision-making was involved. So the most shocking part is that patients were actually put at risk. And one of your sources, I understand, was a clinician in Arizona who was able to recount a number of patients who received false diagnoses and even underwent medical treatment that was not appropriate or not necessary based on what were considered valid lab results. Help us understand, if you can, the depth of harm that was foisted upon the individuals who ended up being directly involved and the threat to patient safety that was really carried out.
Right. That's when the really big red line was crossed, is when they went live with the test in Walgreens stores, first in Palo Alto and then in about 40 Walgreens stores in the Phoenix area. And that was in the late summer and fall of 2013. So by the time I came along and started investigating the company, its tests had been available in Walgreens stores for about a year and a half. And in reporting the story, I went to Phoenix in the spring of 2015, and I talked to several doctors and came across several examples of patients who'd received questionable test results. One of them was a lady who had received test results showing that she had about 6 or 7 abnormal values, and her symptom was that she had ringing in her ears. And when her doctor put the abnormal lab values and the symptom together, became really concerned that the patient was on the cusp of a stroke and sent her immediately to the emergency room. And then the patient underwent a battery of scans and tests for about 4 hours on the eve of Thanksgiving. And then finally, at the end of her stay at the hospital, they ran her labs again, and all those values came back normal. And so at that point, she was released from the hospital, and she had several more MRIs over the ensuing week. And finally, a week later, she and her doctor concluded that it was a false alarm. And so that's one of the examples that I recount in the book. And it's one of the ways in which patients were affected by this giant unauthorized medical experiment.
We're speaking today with John Carreyrou, 2-time Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist at the Wall Street Journal and author of Bad Blood, Secrets and Lies in the Silicon Valley Startup. It's a detailed account of the dramatic rise and fall of the multi-billion-dollar Silicon Valley startup Theranos. John, so many people were duped in this. Not at small levels. These were icons in American politics. Her board of directors was a who's who. Henry Kissinger, former Secretary of State, Bill Frist, former U.S. Senator, surgeon, Sam Nunn, George Shultz. I mean, my God, this is astounding that she could have amassed all of this political capital. So, sir, talk a little bit about that, but also, what's been the fallout? My God, I think that she still seems to be the CEO of the company. I can't help but think there are investigative inquiries going on across the board. But one, how did they get duped, and what's been the fallout here?
Right. So one of Elizabeth's tricks was to gain the support and backing of people, usually older men with prestigious reputations. The first person in that category was Channing Robertson, her engineering professor at the Stanford School of Engineering. And Robertson was well known, and, you know, he accompanied her to venture capital meetings when she dropped out and gave her credibility when she was just a teenager. Then she wrapped Donald L. Lucas around her finger, a pretty well-known venture capitalist who groomed Larry Ellison and helped Larry Ellison take Oracle public in the mid-80s. When Don Lucas started developing Alzheimer's in 2010 and 2011, she pivoted to charming George Shultz, the former Secretary of State who crafted the Reagan administration's foreign policy. Shultz is someone who, though, you know, he's in his 90s, has always been passionate about science. And when he heard Elizabeth sort of unspool her vision, he really bought into it and joined her board. And then he introduced her to all his buddies at the Hoover Institution, which is the conservative think tank housed on the Stanford campus. And that's how she met Henry Kissinger and Sam Nunn and all these other aging statesmen, Bill Perry, who had been Secretary of Defense in the Clinton administration. And that's how she came to have this very powerful board of older men who, by the way, had zero expertise or knowledge about laboratory science. And that gave her credibility with the investors that she conned. She scrupulously avoided VCs who had any medical technology experience. And she targeted basically billionaires and billionaire families, among them Rupert Murdoch, who invested $125 million in Theranos in early 2015, the family of Betsy DeVos, our current education secretary, which put in $100 million. The Cox family, based in Atlanta, which controls Cox Enterprises, they put in $100 million. The heirs of Sam Walton put in $150 million through two different firms. So really, that's how it unfolded. And then with respect to your other question, which is what's going on now, well, she's been charged with fraud by the SEC, and she negotiated a settlement without admitting wrongdoing. But there's also a criminal investigation spearheaded by the U.S. Attorney's Office in San Francisco that's been going on for now 2.5 years. And my sources tell me that that investigation is very advanced and drawing to a conclusion, and that criminal indictments of Elizabeth Holmes and of her boyfriend, Sonny Balwani, are a distinct possibility.
Well, John, I think you've laid out such a picture of some of the weaknesses of human nature. But on the side of what we hope for from technology, this is an incredible illustration of what can happen. We want innovation. We want solutions to some of our vexing problems in medicine and how badly things can go wrong in the fast-moving pace of innovation in healthcare and the real need, the absolute need for rigorous empirical analytics and data. And especially, I think we look at this and say, no peer-reviewed articles in journals on any of this. But the company also pursued rapid approval from the FDA by circumventing certain distinctions and requirements, as I understand it. So what can we learn from the Theranos story that helps us better balance the hopes of innovation in healthcare with the need for the evidence-based research?
Right. Well, I would say in Silicon Valley, and I would say even in American society at large, there's this reverence for entrepreneurialism and innovating, creating startups that within 10 or 15 years become, you know, the next Googles. And I would say that we shouldn't let this reverence excuse wrongdoing. This is Elizabeth is someone who idolized Steve Jobs and idolized Apple, and she wanted to be the second coming of Steve Jobs. And she was going to do anything and everything to get there. And on her way, she and her boyfriend committed wrongdoing. They basically committed fraud, and they put patients in harm's way. And, you know, our reverence for entrepreneurialism shouldn't mean that we let these people get away with playing by different rules. They have to play by the same rules we all play by, and they shouldn't be allowed to cut corners like they did. That's one of the big lessons to me of this story. The other thing that to bear in mind is that there's a convergence right now between traditional tech, traditional Silicon Valley, which is the descendant of the microprocessor industry, and then medicine. And the two are quickly converging. And the Theranos story is a lesson that as this convergence happens, we can't forget that the second you enter the medical realm, you're talking about patients and you're talking about patients' lives. Right. And therefore, you have to do things rigorously and scrupulously, and you have to abide by regulations. Mm-hmm. And it's not by any chance that the healthcare industry is the most regulated in the country. It's for a reason. It's right. Because ultimately, you know, it's patient lives that are at stake.
So, John, put on your psychoanalytic hat. Why did she do it? What do you think? You've sort of got under her skin or psyche in some ways. What was the motivator here?
She's just someone with voracious ambition. You know, I have an anecdote in the book where she's 9 or 10 years old and a relative asks her pretty much the question every boy and girl is asked, which is, what do you want to do when you grow up? And her answer was, I want to be a billionaire. And the relative said, you don't want to be president? And she said, no, the president will marry me because I'll have $1 billion. So that really, it's no exaggeration to say that she wanted to be rich and famous.
Yeah.
And it's a story of someone who pursued that ambition at all costs.
We've been speaking today with John Carreyrou, two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist at The Wall Street Journal and the author of Bad Blood, Secrets and Lies in a Silicon Valley Startup. The book is available on Amazon and in bookstores, and you can also follow Mr. Carreyrou's work at The Wall Street Journal or follow him on Twitter at John Carreyrou, and I'm going to spell that Carreyrou. John, thank you so much for your tenacity, for your investigative journalism, for your reporting, and for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
Thanks very much for having me.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
We saw heated rhetoric on both sides of the aisle when House Republicans pursued a bill that would expand work requirements for the food stamp program. Let's look at the facts on the program and the proposed changes, which are part of the Farm Bill. In February, the most recent month for which we have figures, 40 million people received food stamp benefits. Those are now called the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP. The GOP proposed work requirements would cause 1.2 million fewer people a month to access the benefits by 2028, according to the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office. Under current SNAP rules implemented in 1996, able-bodied adults between the ages of 18 and 49 and without dependents are required to work at least 20 hours a week or participate in a qualified job training or volunteer program in order to be eligible for more than 3 months of benefits over a three-year period. Benefits are cut off after 3 months if the work requirements are not met and the applicant hasn't received a waiver. The proposed GOP law would raise the age of those subject to the work requirement from 49 to 59 and extend the work requirements to adults with children ages 6 and older. The minimum work required would rise to 25 hours per week in 2026. According to the Congressional Budget Office, 62% of those who would lose benefits would be able-bodied adults caring for children 6 or older. Another 27% would be able-bodied adults between the ages of 50 and 59 without dependents. Another proposed change in the bill would cut off SNAP eligibility for those whose gross income exceeds 130% of poverty instead of the 200% threshold for SNAP recipients in some states. That would cause another 400,000 households per year to lose eligibility. According to the USDA, 3.5 million SNAP participants in fiscal 2016 were non-disabled adults living in a household without children, and about 30% of them were working. The bill failed in the House in May, but Congress is expected to take up such legislation again. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Louisville, Kentucky has consistently been on a top 20 list of U.S. cities you don't want to live in if you have a lung disorder. Surrounded by the nation's leading rubber manufacturing entities and nestled in the Ohio River Valley, this is a city that has grappled with pollution. Several years ago, the city's newly hired chief of innovation made a decision to tackle the issue.
I wondered if there was something we might be able to do new and different. Maybe the risk is concentrated in certain places. And if we knew where the risk was concentrated, if that were true, maybe there would be something we could do about it.
And through his work in public health research, Ted Smith had learned of a tech-enabled smart inhaler that, when synced to a person's phone, acted like a GPS for whenever that person needed to use their rescue inhalers.
Essentially, to put a GPS transponder on top of your inhaled medication so that when you took a puff of your medication, it would take a snapshot of what time it was and where you were. And that kind of real-time monitoring of asthma events, especially those rescue inhaler attacks, is a really high-value signal, and you're capturing it in real time.
Smith dubbed the program Air Louisville and tracked 1,100 participants over the course of a year. He said they were able to chart environmental triggers in any given area where an asthma attack occurred and chart real-time data on the conditions and the location, giving them some great public health epidemiology data.
We ended up with a very high spatial resolution map of the burden of asthma in Louisville, Kentucky. And then that led us to explore, you know, where those little micro areas are that are problematic and what we might be able to do about it.
More importantly, the smart inhalers gave users a feedback loop of information which allowed them to better manage their exposure to known asthma triggers.
One part of the use of the technology is the surveillance, but another part of the technology is the feedback loop to the user who learns how poorly controlled or not their asthma is or how adherent they are with the medication they're supposed to be taking daily. And there is an immediate effect. People end up getting better control of their respiratory disease.
Reliance on emergency inhalers dropped 78% among participants, and the city was now armed with data that could help them devise pollution mitigation strategies.
We have the harder problem that I think the rest of the country has, which is our ambient air quality standards are still not low enough, and people are exposed to levels of pollution that we are going to have to work hard to figure out how to remove.
A tech-enabled smart inhaler that gathers meaningful data that informs public health officials how they might reduce the burden of asthma health costs while teaching asthma sufferers to better control their disease and stay healthier. Now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.